from Pepsi, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today, the second hour, we have a special treat. Two guests are going to be joining me to discuss some research they've been doing in relation to cold fusion and aspects of 9/11 research where they're finding parallels. One is Russ Gerst, who has been my guest recently. He's a certified public accountant, a guy who's used to dealing with information in objective fashion. And the other is Morgan Reynolds, the former chief economist in the Department of Labor and the George W. Bush administration, who's become a leading critic of the Bush administration in relation to 9/11. I want to welcome you both to the Dynamic Duo.
Thank you, Jim.
How you doing, Jim?
Real good. Russ, why don't we start with you? We were leaving off last week talking about a book you had been reading, which was discussing the development of cold fusion research and how that whole enterprise wound up being derailed, and where a key player in that whole process was somebody that we're all very familiar with in 9/11.
Yes, the whole book discusses a lot of the issues related to the cold fusion saga. And one of the major players in basically subverting all of the scientific work that could have been done, all of the government money that could have gone into research, was one Stephen Jones. And like we discussed on the last time I was on your show, I was intrigued by it when I saw the information that included his name. A lot of which because of what I'd seen related to the 9/11 truth movement and what had been going on there. And I'm sure Morgan, as he was reading it, had to be thinking he'd seen all of this before.
Morgan, why don't you chime in here? Would that be right that you thought you'd seen it all before?
Well, they say history does not repeat itself, but it rhymes. But this is closer to repeating itself. Fenton Dunn has a radio talk show host where he wandered down the same path, saying that they might have trotted out Stephen Jones one too many times. And in addition, as Russ mentioned earlier, there was that heavy Watergate video that's available online that makes some of these same contentions. But I want to return to your previous guest, Jim, and put this in a bigger context.
Yeah.
And so I looked up the a couple things regarding the Fortune 500, and lo and behold, three of the top revenue corporations in America are oil and gas companies: ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, just to give you some idea of how important oil and gas are. And their combined revenues were last year over $700 billion.
And let me guess, Morgan, their profit margins are among the greatest of any corporation.
They are. They're only exceeded by the financial companies like Citigroup and AIG, Bank of America. But they're very healthy with these high energy prices. And in addition, it's not that I say that the oil and gas companies rule the world. I agree with your previous guest on that. It's more the financial powers that be. But you can see the way our puppets, our elected leaders, think of this, and the neocons, and that is, here's another couple facts that put this in context. Russia is the second largest oil producer in the world after Saudi Arabia. They've got the second largest coal reserves. They are the largest natural gas country in the world. And guess what? You know, they tried to jolly along with Putin, and he wasn't buying in. Remember, Bush and Putin were buddies, so-called?
Yes.
And we are, of course, encircling them and threatening them now with an anti-missile system, on and on. But when you this is the kind of information that the major media, of course, completely neglect. They just are poodles for the powers that be and the government. So my reason for bringing all this up is the context is, what if you had free or semi-free energy?
That would be hugely threatening, obviously. These companies out of business, and their hundreds of billions of dollars of profits would disappear.
Right. And a oil service company like Halliburton, their revenues are over $22 billion a year. So this is the kind of world we're in. And guess what? They can hire some people with brains to squash a threat on the horizon.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's the context. We're playing with the big boys here. You know, I mean, really big. When you some couple of guys in University of Utah come up with an experiment that they claim will produce this on a tabletop cold fusion at room temperatures. Wow, you know, and produce excess heat. That's the real key. So, and then they tried out Stephen Jones. Stephen Jones, in the Mallow book that you and Russ have been discussing, is the third most mentioned person after Fleischmann and Pons, the two University of Utah electrochemists who claimed, hey, we got excess heat in a cold fusion type. We think it's actually a nuclear reaction. It's not a chemical one.
Morgan, before we go too far down this road, why don't you back up and give us a little sketch of the history of this cold fusion research and the role that Steve Jones appears to have played here?
Well, you know, Fleischmann and Pons, in effect, I would say, announced this result prematurely at a press conference on March 23, 1989. But they'd had, you and Russ discussed some of the history leading up to that. Jones really, because he was going to go ahead, pressured them. There was all kinds of pressures about who was going to get patents, who's going to get the grants, who's going to get the fame for original research.
These guys, by the way, were at the University of Utah, were they not?
They were. So they're just a few miles up the road from Stephen
Brigham
Jones
Young University.
At BYU. And
that's curious all by itself, isn't it?
It is. It is. Some people called it the Utah effect because they've had an embarrassment in 1972 where some University of Utah scientists claimed they had an X-ray laser that turned out not to work.
Now, my impression is there's a parallel here with the Zacharias Moussaoui trial where he confessed to one crime in 2005 and then he's being tried for a punishment for a different crime in 2006. My understanding is that Jones' research on cold fusion was actually different in principle than Pons and Fleischmann and was much less successful in producing some excess energy and therefore was used to discredit Pons and Fleischmann, presumably far more successful method.
Yeah, the parallels are very striking. I've got my notes here, and one of them is that even though you're in a kind of a tough crowd playing to scientists, chemists, and electrochemists, Jones plays to the gallery. And his work was very dissimilar to what Fleischmann and Pons were doing. In that Jones, he doesn't use a straightforward electrolyte. He's trying to mimic Mother Earth. There's some weird things going on here. Muon catalyzed fusion.
We'll be right back with my special guests, Russ Gerst and Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, the second hour, I'm joined with my special guest, Russ Gerst, and Morgan Reynolds, and we're talking about cold energy research, but also the role of energy in relation to political power. Morgan, I'm looking at a piece by Michael Clare where he's suggesting that something like energy fascism, the heavily militarized global struggle over diminishing supplies of energy, is going to dominate world affairs for the decades to come. And it's because top government officials are increasingly unwilling to rely on market forces to satisfy national energy needs and are instead assuming direct responsibility for procurement, delivery, and allocation of energy supplies. This really does suggest a real merger of big business with big government, especially the gas and oil companies.
Yes, it does. And, you know, it reminds me about the PNAC document of September 2000, and in which they claimed that our policy should be to even prevent a regional power from arising. So I think the mentality is that you're as a global dominant power, we're going to ration, we're going to control these little Arab states, and instead of just buying from our neighbors, we're violating all the moral principles by thinking as basically as a mafia. You mentioned earlier, I was struck by David Ray Griffin's remarks in his essay in 9/11 and American Empire, where he says, what about the moral principles such as thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's oil, thou shalt not murder thy neighbors in order to steal their oil, and so on. You know, in other words, the free market economist in me says, hey, the resources are where they are, and there's no reason you can't buy and sell and produce peacefully.
Just to make a technical point in moral theory, I mean, principles like the Ten Commandments, especially do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, are rooted in what's known as a deontological morality that's based on the principle of always treating other persons with respect,
right,
as intrinsically valuable rather than merely as means. The group in control here is embracing a very different and overwhelmingly corrupt moral philosophy known as limited utilitarianism, which says whatever is good is whatever maximizes benefits, or in this case profits, for me and my friends, regardless of the consequences for others. So that in a very deep way, we really are talking about a clash of moralities, a completely unscrupulous, unprincipled morality, exemplified by Bush and his cronies and the big oil companies going hell-bent to benefit themselves regardless of the consequences for others, versus a deontological morality that would have us treat everyone with respect.
And I have 2 points here. It turns out that resource endowment, natural resources like energy, is actually not correlated with income per capita or economic growth. Small countries, for example, they do quite well, the Denmarks and the Hong Kongs and so on. And then another point is that look at how self-destructive this all is. Maybe not for the power and financial elite, but we're spending many billions of dollars a month, and not to mention the blood, in treasure, and this is, it's just very destructive. How much oil can you buy? When I saw an estimate the other day that the Iraq war is likely to result in $1.4 trillion in U.S. government expenditures.
Well, you well know the principle of diminishing marginal utility, Morgan, which is, says that when you have no money, every dollar is of enormous value, and as you acquire more and more wealth, then each successive dollar means less and less to you, as it were. And yet it seems to me that the insatiable greed of the rich in this case doesn't even respect the notion of diminishing marginal utility.
Well, I'll leave that as is. Ask Russ a question.
I will indeed, Russ. You must have been fascinating reading this book to discover all of these parallels between research on cold fusion and 9/11. What were some of the most striking features?
Well, I mean, in a very broad view of things, you take cold fusion, you say that equals 9/11. You take the scientists Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischman, you plug in Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds, they're the ones that are being persecuted just for presenting evidence. You step back and you say, okay, now we've got this new process, this, you know, fusion in a jar. You compare that with directed energy weapons. Everybody's, you know, going after this process, the American Physics Society, the whole physics establishment, hot fusion establishment, Department of Energy, all doing the same thing. Now we have a similar situation where everybody supposedly in the 9/11 truth movement says this directed energy weaponry, you know, hypothesis is absolutely crazy. You take another step, you look at muon catalyzed fusion. That's that's what cold fusion could be, and that's all it can be. And you compare that with the new thermite proposal. And then you take a more morbid view of things. Eugene Malov, the actual author of the book, who's pointing out all of these facts, suddenly gets bumped off in 2004. Don't know just where he was in his research of all of the people that were covering things up on cold fusion, but he'd left a very basically lucrative position at MIT as a scientific reporter, probably one of the best positions you could have in the world as far as being on the cutting edge science. And all of a sudden, he decides for ethical reasons, he just can't stay there anymore because the folks there are falsifying science.
Let me guess, Russ. He's bumped off by a couple of muggers.
Yes, in front of his old childhood home, which is now like a rental property that he's trying to kind of restore and clear. Suddenly, he's hit by, you know, a couple of thugs that, you know, have never been truly brought to justice, or if they have, they're just, you know, a couple of dupes. And now you have Michael Xavier, basically the same type of situation.
Very, very, very troubling developments. We'll be right back with my special guests, Russ Kirst and Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host of the Dynamic Duo. Hey, the second hour, I have two guests, Russ Kirst and Morgan Reynolds. And Russ, you seem to me such a sober fellow, a certified public accountant and all that. What was it about this book that struck you when you started looking into cold fusion? I mean, I get the impression that you were really floored by what you perceived to be the parallels.
Well, I was floored, particularly because it just read in basically the same exact order of what has happened since, like, late 2005, when Stephen Jones first came on the scene as the white knight for the 9/11 truth movement, because basically he came out, he was the Boy Scout, the boyish, you know, physicist, which, you know, physicists are held in a basically well above the rest of the scientific community. I mean, all he is pure science. Everything about it is, you know, whatever the data tells him, he's going to report as such. And I mean, the parallels then back to cold fusion, and the neat part about this book was it was written 14 years before he came on the scene with 9/11. So it isn't like, you know, Malov all of a sudden was able to come up with all of this after the fact, and the parallels were made after the fact. He'd written this 15 years before, and it just walked through like a storybook. I mean, he comes on the scene, everybody falls kind of at his feet, you know, he would never tell a lie, he's got this Boy Scoutish quality, and that's exactly how Malov, you know, described him in his book. I mean, he had kind of the poor boy attitude, and he went on and on with that.
Well, of course, I had a role here in bringing him to prominence in the 9/11 community when I founded Scholars by inviting him to be my co-chair, which, of course, happened in December of 2005. And the society took off like a rocket. We had 50 members by the end of December, 100 and 150 within a month or two, soon 300 members. We got to a high of about 500 when the division began to occur late November of 2006 over my desire to broaden the base of research based on Judy and Morgan's extensive compilation of photographic and other evidence that this was almost unlikely to be explainable on the basis of mere cutter charges or conventional explosives, which to my astonishment led to this huge severance between us, where Steve and others sought to destroy Scholars, really froze the website. We had a phony membership vote and all this sort of thing, the history of which is familiar to everyone in the 9/11 movement by now. But where I was really quite taken aback by the vehemence with which he and this clique around him sought to protect him from even the consideration that other possibilities might deserve attention.
Well, and that's another parallel right there, because at the time of the announcement of the cold fusion situation, they had had conversations back and forth prior to the announcement being made, and due to some things that Stephen Jones had kind of been involved with behind the scenes, he tried to kind of approach them to collaborate and work together. Now, it's a little bit different just because you had actually approached him, but I think he would have been looking for someone, you know, within the 9/11 research community to kind of collaborate with and basically keep an eye on folks. And as it worked out, you know, when the scholars group was formed, as it was, yeah, you know, a couple years ago, all of the big names that maybe would be involved from the scientific community, if they were on the up and up and not necessarily there just to be the bashers that we've seen, I mean, they would be kind of brought to that group. And I think we saw that with Dr. Wood and what she brought to the table with her background, and as it worked out then with Morgan kind of coming together and working together. But it's just amazing, those parallels, and they follow all through the book in that similar fashion.
Well, something that has been stunning to me, and I'm sure that Morgan would agree, is that if he and Judy really are crackpots, as they're made out to be, then why bother? Why attack them? Why take the research seriously? Because the more time you devote to discrediting them, the more obvious it becomes that you are taking them seriously, which implies that they actually aren't crackpots after all.
Right, and they did the same thing with Pons and Fleischmann. I mean, the more the data continued to come in that proved that the phenomenon that they were seeing, and really what it was the excess heat. And the only thing that they could explain it with was some sort of nuclear reaction that could create the volume of heat relative to the size of the materials in the flask, because it was monumentally too great for any chemical reaction. And it's the same parallel.
And we're talking about some kind of reaction, the exact principles of which were at that point in time not known, and may only now be gradually coming into clarity.
Right. And similarly with the paper that Morgan and Dr. Wood put out, they didn't know the causation, but they were able to theorize about, you know, what it was that they were seeing and what they were able to basically, you know, draw away from as far as a causative agent. And, you know, the thermite hypothesis may be able to explain small portions of things, but when you look from the vertical views of the World Trade Center complex and see the volume of holes in the other buildings that were left standing, and then you see the lack of material and everything else, it's like, okay, there's got to be another causative agent.
And even in his chapter in 9/11 and American Empire, edited by David Ray Griffin and Peter Dale Scott, he concedes his astonishment when the top 30 floors of the South Tower began to tilt over and then all of a sudden were pulverized, turned into very fine powder.
And there's one video that shows, you know, the top portion of the building coming down, and the remaining portion of the building stays right there. And it's like, how is it just kind of disappearing into the building without causing any problem to the rest of the building? So, but there again, I mean, a lot of the parallels were, you know, don't focus on the excess heat. Look at the fact that there were missing nuclear products that, you know, were the basis of all the physicists' problem with cold fusion. Same justification for all the bashers of Woods and Reynolds' theory, that just because, you know, you don't know what it is that caused these phenomena that we're seeing in all the pictures, doesn't mean it didn't happen.
And there seems to me to be a fundamental confusion in the criticisms directed against them, because the claims are being made repeatedly, especially by Stephen Jones, that their research is not evidence-based, when in fact there's overwhelmingly more evidence that they produced, hard evidence, photographic evidence, you know, analyses and so forth, mathematical calculations than I have found in all of Steve Jones' work on thermite and thermate.
Sure.
That seems to me a particularly egregious example of an unjustifiable criticism, one which would be more appropriately directed at his own work rather than at theirs.
Yes, and it boils all the way down to, if you don't have the answer, obviously the phenomena didn't occur or exist, and that's totally backward.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my two special guests, Russ Gerst and Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, the second hour, my special guests are Russ Gerst and Morgan Reynolds, and we've been talking about parallels between Stephen Jones' role in relation to cold fusion research and his role in relation to 9/11 research, where the parallels are rather disturbing. Morgan, you listened to our first my first guest today, I believe, Dr. Stephen Greer. I wondered if you found anything particularly striking about what he had to say in relation to all of these issues of 9/11.
Well, the main thing he said about 9/11 was completely wrong. He had advocated LIHOP, let it happen on purpose.
Oh, I know that's true, yeah.
That is ridiculous in that, of course, I'm a no-planer. There weren't any Arab hijackers. Arab hijackers couldn't make planes disappear, violate the laws of physics, which the government would have us believe.
He's obviously not an expert on 9/11, but I thought perhaps you'd pick up on his discussion about the use of very sophisticated weapons that are, in many cases, space-based. These are, you know, products of the Star Wars research program.
Well, that was supportive of Judy's work on DEW, aided and abetted by yours truly. What he had to say about compartmentalization and powers that be and the like also would support 9/11 in that sections of our subsectors of our government engineered 9/11, aided and assisted by certain outsiders. But I want to go back to Stephen Jones' role in both of these events, one being the cold fusion, the other 9/11.
Sure.
And focus a little more narrowly on Stephen Jones' science. And the bottom, I'm not sure it's the bottom line, but maybe it's the top line here, is Russ pointed out that Stephen Jones has been kind of a white knight in 9/11. And that's true. And he, what is scary is that he's playing a much bigger role in 9/11 as the hero physical scientist than the role he played in cold fusion, which was important to be sure, but there were a lot of smart people in the physics community, especially in the hot fusion area, that never accepted a word of what Jones said. And that's very similar to what I advocate. I don't believe a thing he says any more than the government unless I can prove it quite independently of what he says.
Let me ask you about a couple of basic aspects of the so-called, you know, criticism of you and Judy, perhaps of Judy especially, which is that her research is supposed to not be evidence-based. I mean, they throw around these phrases like star beams and suggest that we're talking about little green men, when in fact Judy has been open to a whole range of possible alternative modes of delivery of directed energy, where the evidence, it seems to me, is a very hard evidence in the form of all of the photographs of the pulverization of the building, the massiveness of the destruction of the World Trade Center, as Russ was observing, the distinctive features of damage to Building 6, 5, 4, and 3, the time with which these buildings were destroyed, the non-functional damage of the bathtub, the failure of the subways and the path-trade tunnels to be flooded, the apparent absence of molten metal, strikingly, the role of the dust in relation to having these massive effects on the automobiles, the huge quantity of dirt. I mean, she has been demonstrating all of these features of the situation for months and months and months. And
well,
what they suggest her research is not evidence-based seems to me to bespeak of either a conceptual confusion or a deliberate effort to confuse and distort the evidential situation.
I agree, and his negativity is not supported by the facts, And his positive contributions is not supported either. And this was foreshadowed, I'm going to give you an example, by his role in cold fusion. And as I say, he didn't play quite as big a role, and that's what's scary, as he's playing in 9/11. To begin, his method of operation, his experiment, his results were quite different than Fleischmann and Pons. Steve's main result was that he got some neutron, which were not kind of a smallish effects, as one scientist said, kind of 2 or 3 sigma above what you'd expect, okay? Smallish. And as Jones downplayed this result, we'll never get any great energy gain out of this. And he's throwing a wet blanket kind of on the commercial possibilities of his results if they were true. And Fleischmann and Pons, on the other hand, of course, focused on the excess heat. And if you strip away the secondary criticisms, there were 2 main criticisms. One is Fleischmann and Pons had no theory for their result, their excess heat result. In other words, we'd need some new physics to explain this.
Yes.
And secondly, there was a reproducibility problem in that a lot of scientists couldn't come up with this excess heat result, so it was very clear that there were side conditions, unknown experimental differences, and so on that had to be sorted out. Well, what about Jones' results? Well, you subject them to the same standard. There was no theory for his result of some neutrons escaping. And secondly, you ought to read what his Mother Earth soup, the electrolyte, was a complex concoction of chemicals they thought might mimic the geochemical features causing cold fusion within the Earth. So this, a lot of people, especially in the physics community, never believed Stephen Jones' stuff.
That's really fascinating, Morgan. You know,
and here's the real upshot, the real inconsistency in Jones' approach here that is was foreshadowing his 9/11 role, is that Jones believed that cold fusion could somehow explain the hellish conditions within the Earth, but Fleischmann and Pons cold fusion couldn't produce excess heat. You know, so what? Wait a minute. You're telling me on the one hand cold fusion can't produce excess heat in any significant quantity, but you believe that cold fusion can produce gobs of excess heat within the Earth? Which is it?
Those are my points. What I'd like to inject here is that seems to me to be a confusion about the nature of testability versus replicability on Jones' approach. I mean, there's obviously the testability here, that whether or not thermate, for example, could be responsible for all of these effects. If you have effects that are present in the data that can't be explained by thermite and thermate, that's evidence that some causative mechanism other than thermite and thermate was involved. And in my opinion, Judy and you have done this in spades, demonstrating that there's a far vaster range of effects here than could possibly be accounted for on the basis of thermite and thermate. Now, it's true that, strictly speaking, until one specifies a specific type of mechanism, like a certain type of laser or maser or plasmoid or antimatter mechanism or fourth generation mini nuke or whatever, you don't have replicability in the sense that you could posit that mechanism and determine or make a calculation of the effects that would be produced. But here, ironically, I find Jones has not done that for thermite and thermate, where he has specified a mechanism, so that Judy and you are being criticized when you haven't specified a mechanism, which means you've got actually a theory that's got general testable implications, because you're talking about ranges of effects that go beyond thermite and thermate, and yet Jones has made no effort, it seems to me, to demonstrate that thermite and thermate can account for the effects that are in the data.
Right, and his behavior, it's the same guy back in the cold fusion controversy.
Morgan Reynolds, Russ Gerst, I want to thank you both for coming on to the Dynamic Duo, and I look forward to extending my conversation with you, Morgan Reynolds, tomorrow. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thank you for listening.